You're listed first.
Yeah.
See? Get more.
Mm-hmm. Future for me. I'm sure it doesn't belong to
college. In the interest of starting right on time, we'll start.
Be excommunicated.
Right. This is a dual paper session with two papers on concerning Joseph Smith. Our two presenters are Christopher Smith, who will speak on The Great Spirit Has Told Us That You Are the Man, American Indian Delegation to Joseph Smith at Nauvoo. Christopher has a BA in Biblical Studies from Fresno Pacific University and an MA in the History of Christianity from Wheaton College, and he's currently pursuing a PhD here in Religions in North America. He's recently been published in several journals, academic journals, including the John Whitmer Journal and the Journal for the Renewal of Religion and Theology, and he also has a paper scheduled for dialogue this summer. He is originally from Sacramento, living here while he pursues his PhD. Brian Cottle received his BA from Boise State University in history, U.S. history emphasis. He grew up in Boise. He is living here at the current time, working on his MA degree at Claremont Graduate University in the History of Christianity and Religions of North America. They will present their papers, and then we'll have a short time for questions at the end. Now, I've been asked to remind everybody to turn off any cell phones, and there will be recordings done by Sunstone, so you don't need to do that. I don't think either of you gentlemen have books out here, do you? Later, in your later years, you're very
someday.
Young.
Someday. A couple of years.
Yes.
Give me some time.
So we will start with the paper by Brother Smith.
All right. Title of my paper is "The Great Spirit Has Told Us That You Are the Man, American Indian Delegations to Joseph Smith at Nauvoo." So before his death in 1844, Joseph Smith entertained at least 7 different delegations of American Indians at Nauvoo. These meetings have received very little attention from either Mormon or Native American historians. None of the major recent biographies of Joseph Smith make any reference to the Indian visitors. And even those historians who do notice the visits frequently do so only in passing. Similar remarks could be made about biographies of the Indian chiefs and tribes that visited the prophet. I'm aware of only one recent work on American Indian history that mentions any of the delegations, and it does so only in a chapter on Mormon missionary efforts. So suffice to say, there's never been a comprehensive study of these visitations. The delegations that visited Nauvoo represented factions of the Potawatomi, Sauk, and Fox tribes. These tribes had long been divided between the traditionalists, who allied themselves with Britain in the hope of resisting American expansion, and the progressives, who felt that resistance was impossible and that the best strategy was accommodation to American interests. Britain carefully cultivated its traditionalist Indian allies in the Americas until its defeat in the War of 1812, when it gave up its New World ambitions and abandoned its Indian vassals. The traditionalist Indians, though, were slow to accept Britain's exit. They continued to visit British forts in Canada and to lobby for British military aid. Most of the Indian groups that visited Joseph Smith were traditionalists who either mistook Joseph for a British officer or hoped that he might replace the British king as their white patron and military ally. We know that on at least one occasion, when a non-Mormon observer was present, Smith explicitly turned down an Indian offer of military alliance. Probably he was motivated by public relations concerns. He was lobbying the government for redress of grievances at the time and did not want to tarnish the church's image or to provoke further animosity from non-Mormon settlers. At the same time, though, he staged military demonstrations for the Indian visitors and kept most of his communications with them shrouded in secrecy. It's difficult to know what he was telling the Indian delegates when non-Mormon observers were present. Clearly, he had not abandoned the religious vision of the Book of Mormon, which envisioned the cataclysmic destruction of the United States by the Indians. If anything, these events were merely deferred for practical reasons. So I'll start by looking at the context of the Mormon views of Indians and the place of Indians in the religious vision of Joseph Smith and in the Book of Mormon. According to the Book of Mormon, the Indians are descended from a clan of nomadic, thieving, idolatrous, wild, ferocious, bloodthirsty nudists called the Lamanites. Because of their wickedness, God curses the Lamanites with dark skin. Although these descriptions of the Lamanites are pretty heavily stereotyped, the Book of Mormon also subverts the stereotypes by making the Lamanites God's chosen people to be gathered to an American New Jerusalem and restored to divine favor. The Gentile white Americans who fail to convert to Mormonism are warned of their impending annihilation at the Indians' hands. Early Mormons believed that this cataclysm would occur within just a few years. After the publication of the Book of Mormon and the founding of the church in 1830, the first order of business was to begin evangelizing the Indians. Oliver Cowdery and Parley Pratt were dispatched on a mission to Kansas. In addition to missionary work, they were instructed to choose a site for the New Jerusalem among the Lamanites, that is, beyond the borders of the United States, in Indian territory. The mission was cut short when Cowdery and Pratt were booted off the reservation because they had neglected to obtain the proper permits. The missionaries angrily vowed to go to the Rocky Mountains to escape the government's reach, but never made good on the threat. Mormon missions to the Gentiles were more successful. Joseph Smith moved to Kirtland after Sidney Rigdon's congregation there converted. Cowdery and Pratt turned their attention to evangelizing whites as well. Since building the New Jerusalem among the Lamanites would be illegal, they selected a site for New Jerusalem in Jackson County, Missouri, near the Kansas border. These initial disappointments led Joseph Smith to de-emphasize the Indian mission, but not to give it up entirely, as some historians have actually proposed that he gave it up entirely, and I disagree with that. He continued to dream of carrying the gospel to the Rocky Mountains, and although anti-Mormon violence in Missouri made it necessary to be discreet about the Indian missions, Joseph continued to endorse them on the sly. The Saints apparently maintained contact with the Indians of Kansas throughout the Missouri period. This became a major grievance for their Missouri neighbors. The Missourians knew that the Book of Mormon prophesied the annihilation of the Gentiles by the Indians, and they also knew that they were the Gentiles. They strongly suspected the Mormons of actively inciting the Indians to violence. The secretive manner of the Mormons' mission efforts only fueled the old settlers' suspicions. When the Saints were expelled from Missouri, the militia actually positioned itself in between the Mormons, the evacuating Mormons, and the Indians in order to prevent the Indians from coming to their aid militarily. In Illinois, the Saints again established their city on the edge of Indian territory and again turned their attention to the Lamanite mission. Joseph sent several missionaries, including Oneida Indian Jonathan Dunham, to carry the gospel to the Indians of Kansas and Minnesota. He was again quite secretive about these activities, even in the private records of the church. The missionaries' own diaries are equally sparse. We see the same secretive quality in Mormon accounts of Joseph's later meetings with Indians to Nauvoo. Compared to non-Mormon accounts of these same meetings, the Mormon tellings seem radically sanitized and truncated. The Mormon interest in the Indians and the Indian interest in the Mormons were mutually reinforcing. Some of the Indian delegations came to Nauvoo after encountering Mormon missionaries, and some of them were even escorted personally back to Nauvoo by Jonathan Dunham. The delegations then prompted Smith to send out more missionaries. He also renewed his cataclysmic rhetoric after the Indians arrived, prophesying the entire overthrow of this nation in a few years. And he also made plans for an emigration to California, Oregon, or the Rocky Mountains, and promised in his last recorded discourse that the Indians would be, quote, a bulwark of protection from your foes, unquote. If Joseph had forgotten about his dream of a Mormon city of refuge in Indian territory, the Indian delegations to Nauvoo seem to have reminded him of it. We also, in order to understand the delegations, need to know about the political situation the Indians were in the 1840s. The Indian delegations that visited Nauvoo came from communities in severe crisis. They had just been evicted from their homelands in Michigan, Illinois, and Missouri under the policy of Indian removal, and resettled in Iowa and Kansas. And now, just a few years later, they were being threatened with removal from Iowa and Kansas as well. All attempts to stem the tide of American expansionism had utterly failed. There were really no good options left to them, and so their communities were deeply divided over what to do. The delegates came from three tribes, the Sauk, Fox, and Potawatomi tribes. All three had very similar languages and cultures. They lived a semi-nomadic lifestyle in which they left their villages during the winter to hunt buffalo, but planted corn the rest of the year. This lifestyle was in severe peril in the 1840s. Their lands were shrinking and the buffalo were disappearing. Famine was a major problem. In order to feed themselves during the winter, the Indians became more and more dependent on the annual annuity payments from the government. Since these payments were funded by land sales, this meant that they had to continually sell more and more of their lands to keep their incomes flowing, which of course only exacerbated the problem of famine. Accommodation to white culture was beginning to seem like the only viable way to avert their own extinction. Their traditional social systems were breaking down as well. U.S. officials worked hard to bolster the leadership of pro-American chiefs and to subvert the leadership of anti-American ones. This meant subverting the traditional clan system and granting an unprecedented amount of power to a single leader or small group of leaders. With a few pro-American chiefs representing entire tribes of Indians, it was much easier for white officials to exploit the Indians and to negotiate cheap land purchases at the Indians' expense. These exploitative policies created strong resentment among the traditionalist factions. The factional split between progressive Indians who favored accommodation and traditionalists who favored resistance was nothing new in the 1840s. In fact, it actually predated the American Revolution. During the Revolution, the British made themselves the champions of the traditionalist Indians' cause, and after the war, they continued to cultivate a small empire of Indian allies. The split between progressives and traditionalists, in fact, began to be a more important distinction than the old tribal distinctions. Traditionalists from many different tribes, including the Potawatomi, united in the early 19th century under the Shawnee prophet Tenskwatawa and his brother Tecumseh. Tecumseh's Confederacy fought the Americans at the Battle of Tippecanoe in 1811 and then joined the British in the War of 1812. The British were also supported by some Sauk and Fox traditionalists under their war leader Blackhawk. The War of 1812 exposed a gaping rift in the Sauk, Fox, and Potawatomi tribes. They divided into traditionalist British bands and progressive peace bands. The peace bands tended to be led by elderly, pragmatic chiefs who in some cases had been considerably enriched by bribes from their American patrons. The British bands typically were led by young, enthusiastic warriors who believed the old chiefs had signed away their inheritances. These factions persisted after the defeat of the British in 1812. The era of British military intervention in the Americas had come to an end, but their Indian allies were slow to accept this fact. So when in 1828 the U.S. government evicted the Sauk and Fox from all their lands east of the Mississippi, there were some who believed that the eviction could be resisted and that the British and the Potawatomi traditionalists would come to their aid militarily. The principal leader of the Sauk and Fox, who later visited Joseph Smith at Nauvoo, was Keokuk. Keokuk was a progressive who had seen the size and wealth of the great American cities in the East and knew that there was no chance of successful Indian resistance. He did his best to minimize the damage through diplomacy, but he believed military action was suicide. He grudgingly granted the legality of the land seizure and evacuated his people across the Mississippi into Iowa. He was supported in this action by most of the other chiefs of the tribe, including a chief named Appanoose, who later accompanied to Keokuk and Nauvoo in 1841. Keokuk's main traditionalist rival was a war leader named Blackhawk. Blackhawk thought Keokuk was a greedy American sycophant. He thought it was outrageous that Keokuk was going to let the whites plow up the bones of their ancestors. Blackhawk consulted an Indian prophet named Wabokishik, who reassured him that he could safely reoccupy the village and the British in Pottawatomie would support him militarily and the Americans would not attack him. Black Hawk did so, reoccupied the village with a band of warriors, women, and children in 1832. The Americans considered this an act of war, and they engaged and pursued Black Hawk as he retreated with his band back toward Iowa. The promised British and Pottawatomie support never came, and about 200 of Black Hawk's followers, including many women and children, were massacred by American soldiers as they tried to swim back across the river to Iowa. After the war, Black Hawk and his allies, Waboki Shiuk and the chief Neopope, were imprisoned for a while, but eventually released into the custody and supervision of Keokuk. Historians have generally assumed that this was the end of the pro-British faction. Keokuk and the progressives had won the day, and his traditionalist rivals retired or died in disgrace. As the Mormon records show, it's a very different story. Actually, one of the delegations in 1843 was led by a brother of Black Hawk, and it progressed, professed loyalty to Neopope and vocally condemned Keokuk's land concessions. So apparently the Sauk and Fox British band was still alive and well in the early 1840s when Joseph Smith received the delegations. So with that context in mind, let's look at the accounts of the delegations themselves. The first of the delegations to visit Nauvoo was actually a progressive group rather than a traditionalist one. About 100 Sauk and Fox arrived on August 12, 1841. The group was led by the accommodationist chiefs Keokuk and Apanus. The Indians camped across the river for several days before ferrying over for a visit. The delay before their visit indicates that they had not made the 100-mile journey from their villages specifically for the purpose of visiting the Mormons. We're not told why they encamped there, but we can infer from the timing of the visit that they had escorted their Indian agent to the Mississippi River so that he could catch a steamboat to St. Louis and bring back the annual annuity funds. Concerned that the critics in the tribe might try to seize the money, Keokuk brought a large group of his followers to help protect the money en route. When the Indian delegates crossed the river to Nauvoo, Joseph met with them and instructed them concerning the history of their fathers and the promises that were made concerning them in the Book of Mormon. He urged them to keep peace with whites and with fellow Indians. In a speech which brought tears to the eyes of a number of gallant soldiers of the Legion and squaws and papooses in attendance, Keokuk reported that he owned a copy of the Book of Mormon and believed Smith to be a great and good man. "I look rough," Keokuk admitted, "but I also am a son of the Great Spirit. I've heard your advice. We intend to quit fighting and follow the good talk you have given us." Joseph's message was reasonably well suited to his visitors. Keokuk and Apanus had long been advocates of peace, both with whites and with other Indians. Joseph's eschatology, though, must have seemed strange. The prophet spoke of the glorious times that the Mormons and Indians would have together in the latter-day city of the New Jerusalem. The baffled Keokuk reportedly replied that it depended very much whether there would be any government annuities there. Smith's proposal cannot have seemed very realistic. It was a clear violation of the U.S. Indian policy to which Keokuk had spent his entire career accommodating. The next several delegations that Joseph received were from the Pottawatomie rather than the Sauk and Fox, who would not visit him again until 1844. The first and most interesting Pottawatomie group arrived from Kansas on April 18, 1843. The delegation consisted of three Pottawatomie chiefs who had recruited a non-Mormon as their translator. It's clear from the translator's account that the three chiefs were pro-British Indians who utterly despised the United States and didn't want anything to do with any American official. What isn't clear is whether they fully understood who Joseph Smith was. They knew that he was a prophet, and they asked him to consult the Great Spirit and to advise them what to do. But they also seemed to have believed that he was a British officer. When the translator tried to convince them otherwise, they refused to believe him and claimed that they had been repeatedly informed this by the whites. Presumably the missionaries, but the missionaries escorted them to Nauvoo, and obviously since they recruited a non-Mormon translator, the missionaries didn't speak their language very well, so this may have simply been a miscommunication on the part of the missionaries. The Indians even produced a silver British medal to prove their loyalty to the crown. In any case, the spokesman for the group a chief named Apakwachaba presented a startling proposal. After complaining at some length about the way the Indians had been treated by white settlers on the frontier, they asked the Mormons to join in a military alliance with 10 tribes who had agreed to defend each other to the last extremity. Joseph turned them down for, quote, his hands were tied by the U.S., unquote, but he offered them his sympathies. The Indians then asked him to send some of his chiefs back with him, or back with them, perhaps to accompany them to a large intertribal council scheduled for a few months later. When Joseph refused again, they left disappointed, but promised to come back later that year. The firmness of Smith's refusal on this occasion may have much to do with the presence of a somewhat antagonistic non-Mormon translator. The Mormons could not afford a repeat of the Missouri fiasco. Another group of Potawatomi visited Nauvoo on June 25th and 26, 1843, and toured the Nauvoo house and the temple. They were apparently just passing through, but while they were in Nauvoo, they expressed a desire to speak with the Mormon leaders on religious subjects. Unfortunately, they had no interpreter and so were not able to communicate much. The delegation of the Potawatomi chiefs returned, this time with its own translator, at the end of June. They met with Joseph, several of the 12, and about 20 of the elders on July 2, 1843. After being assured that all present were friends who could be trusted not to divulge the secrets of the meeting, the Indians complained that the Americans had driven them from their lands, hated them, and shed their blood until it seemed that there would soon be no Indians left. But they added, "We have talked with the Great Spirit, and the Great Spirit has talked with us, and we have asked the Great Spirit to save us and let us live. And the Great Spirit has told us that he had raised up a great prophet, chief, and friend, who would do us great good and tell us what to do. And the Great Spirit has told us that you are the man," pointing to the prophet Joseph. "We have now come a great way to see you and hear your words, and to have you tell us what to do." This remarkable passage reveals that the members of this particular delegation genuinely believed in Joseph Smith's powers as a prophet. Given the militaristic overtones of their earlier visit, they may have envisioned him as a warrior prophet like Tenskwatawa, who would unite the tribes in a pan-Indian confederacy against the United States. This should not be too surprising, given the similarity of the Book of Mormon's message to that of Tenskwatawa's. The Book of Mormon envisioned an Indian conquest of Gentile America, and also asserted a common lineage for all Indians that would bind them together as a single community. Smith was deeply moved by the Indian speech. After shedding some tears, he rehearsed the broad outlines of the Book of Mormon narrative and offered them some promises and instructions. "The Great Spirit will soon begin to talk with you and your children," he told them. "The Book of Mormon tells what you will have to do. I now want you to begin to pray to the Great Spirit. I want you to make peace with one another and do not kill any more Indians. It is not good. But ask the Great Spirit for what you want, and it will not be long before the Great Spirit will bless you, and you will cultivate the earth and build good houses like white men. We will give you something to eat and take home with you." When the prophet's words were interpreted to all the chiefs, they all said it was good. The chief asked how many moons it would be before the Great Spirit would bless them. He told them not a great many. Much of this probably resonated with Smith's visitors. The commandments to pray to the Great Spirit and to stop killing other Indians had been key aspects of the message of Tenskwatawa. Other aspects probably did not. These were traditionalist Indians and may not have reacted well to the idea that they should build houses like white men and cultivate the earth in the Euro-American manner. More important, though, was the promised blessing. The Indians ask at the end of their message how many moons it would be before the blessing comes. In Christian cultures, a promise of a blessing is usually viewed as little more than a social nicety. But in Indian cultures, one sought the help of a prophet or medicine man in order to gain insight into the future and to benefit from various kinds of sympathetic magic. Smith's promise of a blessing would have been taken very literally. More than anything else Smith offered, this proffered blessing had the potential to provide the material relief they desperately needed. Another delegation of 5 Potawatomi and their white interpreter arrived on August 26, 1843, in the company of LDS missionary Jonathan Dunham. Unfortunately, we have very little information about the meeting itself, except that the Indians, quote, wished Joseph Smith to become their great father, unquote. Even this slim report is highly suggestive, however. In Indian parlance, the terms father and great father had strong political connotations. Indian vassals used these terms to refer to their white patrons. White military officers were referred to as father, and white sovereigns as great father. By asking Joseph to become their great father, the Indians were effectively asking him to become their political patron, perhaps in the place of the British king. Although we have no record of the August 28th meeting itself, we do have a copy of a letter that Joseph addressed to the Potawatomi in response. In the letter, Smith accepts the role of father to the Indians, but in a familial rather than political sense of the term. He seems aware that the term has a political dimension, but declines to conduct any business on the Indians' behalf unless he is appointed to do so by the U.S. government. He advises them not to sell any more of their lands and promises to give them further advice if needed, but that is all he is able to offer. He then promises to send a map of Potawatomi lands with the letter, presumably to help guard against further American appropriations, as well as to send the bearer with additional, possibly confidential, explanations and instructions. Shrouded in similar mystery is a group of Lamanites that met with the Council of 50 on April 4, 1843, and attended General Conference 2 days later. We unfortunately have no further information about these Indians, except that their interview with the Council was very pleasant and impressive. The last of the known Indian delegations to Nauvoo before the death of Joseph Smith arrived on May 22, 1844. This group was composed of Sauk and Fox of the traditionalist British Band faction. The delegation consisted of about 40 Indians, including a brother of the great war leader Black Hawk that actually was previously unknown until found in Mormon sources. The delegates also professed loyalty to the famous chief Neopope, who had been a co-leader with Black Hawk in the Black Hawk War of 1832. Joseph met the delegates in his kitchen. In their speech to Joseph, the Sauk and Fox traditionalists spoke with a mixture of pride and despair. They were quick to point out that Nauvoo stood on land that had belonged to their tribe just a few decades before. In fact, Nauvoo was built over the remains of the village of Chief Quashquame, who was the principal signatory of the infamous 1804 treaty that had bartered away the tribe's Illinois lands. Repeatedly in their meeting with Joseph, the delegates revisited this point and emphasized their fond memories of the place. Fond memories, meanwhile, were balanced by harsh present realities. In 1842, Keokuk had sold all remaining Sauk and Fox lands in Iowa. A little more than a year after their visit to Nauvoo, these Indians would have to relocate to a new home in Kansas. "Our chiefs done wrong in selling our country," they complained. "We are very poor. Whites cheat us. But no difference, not long to live." Joseph seems to have taken the Indians' insistence that this land was once theirs as an accusation. "We know you have been wrong, but we bought this land and paid our money for it," he protested. But in the context of the Indian speech, the talk of the tribe's past land claim there seems to have served a more positive rhetorical function. The Indians admit, in fact, that theirs was not the original claim to the land. Before they arrived, the Spanish were there. Later, the British and French arrived. All spoke to the Great Spirit there and worshipped in their own ways. They seem to have emphasized the religious and magical connection with the land. The point of all this was apparently to show the religious and racial equality of whites and Indians and to establish common religious ground. Their mutual claim on the land implied their ultimate equality. Quote, "Our worship is different, but we are as good as any other men," they insisted. "We different color, no difference." One of the more perplexing statements in the Mormon account of this speech is the comment that the Indians, quote, "wanted Joseph to talk right to be our big chief," unquote. Probably this should be read as an endorsement of Joseph's presidential candidacy. What they meant by "they wanted him to talk the right talk" is not clear, but perhaps it means that they wanted him to talk like an imperialist so that he could get into office and then advocate their concerns. In his reply to the Indians, Joseph touched upon characteristic themes. He advised the Indians not to sell their land and instructed them to live in peace with other tribes and told them about the Book of Mormon. After the meeting, the Indians performed a 2-hour war dance for the saints and the saints provided music and fired off their cannon. Despite this symbolic show of strength and common cause, both groups would be expelled from their lands within the year. When one reads the accounts of the encounters of the early 1840s between Joseph Smith and his Indian visitors, one cannot help but conclude that in many cases the two parties were talking past each other. It's doubtful that Joseph Smith understood the complexities of the Indian political scene, with its ongoing factional divisions in the aftermath of the War of 1812 and the Black Hawk War. It's also unlikely that the Indians understood the political circumstances that forced Joseph Smith to be so circumspect in all of his dealings with them. The good news is that where the different sides in these exchanges failed to fully understand each other, historians are in a position to do a little better. We can now assess the implications of the Nauvoo delegations for both Mormon and Native American historiographies. In the case of Mormonism, we learn that Joseph Smith's interest in an Indian New Jerusalem persisted throughout his lifetime, but became increasingly subordinate to practical concerns about the church's public image, at least until the flood of American Indian delegations came to Nauvoo during the 1840s and reawakened and revitalized that vision. On the Native American side, we learn that traditionalist factions of the Potawatomi and Fox and Sauk Indians long outlived British power in North America. In the vacuum left by the British, they looked desperately for other sources of help, including to the Mormons in Nauvoo. Joseph Smith was both a warrior prophet like Tenskwatawa and a white political leader with considerable prestige and a large socioeconomic base. Unfortunately, Joseph Smith did not live long enough to see his meetings with the Indians bear substantive fruit in the form of Mormon-Indian cooperation. The meetings did have important consequences, though. When the Mormons were expelled from Illinois, they took temporary refuge on Potawatomi lands as they prepared to journey to Utah. Thus, although the Mormons never aided the Indians in the ways the delegations had hoped, the Indians did provide a refuge and a bulwark of protection as Smith had prophesied. It seems very probable that the Mormons went to the Potawatomi for help precisely because of the relationships established in their meetings with these delegations. Ultimately, it was the Indians rather than the Mormons who served as patrons and protectors. Thanks.
We want to thank Christopher for this very fascinating paper. We won't have questions. We have questions. Make a note of them and we'll ask them at the end because we want to make sure to get the total of the other paper in. Next we'll hear from Brian Cottle, who will speak on Joseph Smith as a spiritual egalitarian.
Many histories have been written about the Mormon prophet Joseph Smith since he founded the Mormon movement in 1830. Through these histories, many images have been conceptualized and propagated regarding the character of this man, whose life spanned only 38 years. Joseph Smith had been portrayed as a fraud, a charlatan, and a deceiver. When it came to Smith's church organization, Ezra Booth, a member for a brief period, felt that Smith was ruling as a dictator. Referring to Smith and the church's organization, Booth declared, "It is like this. A sovereign issues his decrees and then says to his subjects, 'Hold up your right hands in favor of my decrees being carried into effect. Should any refuse, they are sure to be hung for rebellion.' Yet there have been many histories which attempt to show Smith was not a harsh man, but a genuine leader and a prophet as well. The image of Joseph Smith that this paper will present is one of a spiritual egalitarian. By spiritual egalitarian, I refer to an individual that desires to have everybody experience visions and matters of spirituality just as they themselves experience it. In viewing general events throughout the life of the prophet and considering his declared doctrines, there is enough evidence to suggest this portrayal of Smith. Throughout his prophetic career, all the doctrines and organizational matters Smith perpetuated were built upon his early inclinations to help others see visions and experience spirituality as he did. For the sake of this presentation, I will break this spiritual egalitarian, spiritual egalitarianism into two categories, the visionary element and the organizational element. First, the visionary element. In order to understand Joseph Smith's inclinations to have others experience visions and manifestations, it is important to understand the visionary culture that Smith grew up in and the part his family played in helping him accept the validity of visions. Visionary experiences were frequent in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. In his study of visionary culture in the United States, Richard Bushman discovered 32 pamphlets published between 1783 and 1815 relating to visionary experiences. These in and of themselves are personal experiences that only recipients of such visions published. It is logical to assume that there were many more such experiences in this period that were not published. In this time of religious revival and excitement, visionary experiences were becoming common. As individuals sought out religion for their salvation, they wanted spiritual experiences to prove that they had been converted. It is only in understanding this commonality of these visionary experiences that we can realize the fertile environment that created in Joseph Smith Jr. not only the acceptance of visionary experiences, but the desire to help others obtain those experiences. Even with this fertile environment of visionary experience, acceptance of visions did not come easy to Smith, as he had to struggle for his belief in them. If there is anything that we can learn from Smith's first vision, it is this fact. Visions brought answers. The religious revivals left him confused and without answer for the salvation of his soul. Smith was in emotional unrest. The only way to solve his problems was to go to the woods and pray. And so that is what Smith did. And to his utmost joy, upon praying, he saw two personages in a vision. He had a vision, and in the process, he had become converted. He received his answer, but his acceptance of visions did not start here. Like those past visionaries who had visions and published them, Smith felt he at least needed to tell somebody. This is most likely why Smith, a short time after his experience in the Grove, told a Methodist preacher of his vision. Notably, not all religious preachers were fond of the abundant visionary experiences that people proclaimed. Smith found this out the hard way when the preacher rebuked him and told him that his experience was of the devil. After much uneasiness, Smith felt he had been given an answer to his prayer, the answer he felt his soul was searching for. He had to decide whether to A, listen to the preacher, or B, believe what he had seen. Smith chose the latter, as he felt, I had seen a vision, I knew it, and I knew that God knew it, and I could not deny it. Smith had made his decision despite what others told him to believe. Smith believed that visions and spiritual manifestations were of God. Such acceptance of visions by Joseph Smith was also nurtured in his own family. When he saw in several visions the angel Moroni, who discussed a work the Lord had for him to do, and that he would bring forth an ancient record that would become the Book of Mormon, Moroni also instructed Smith to tell his father all that he had learned. Smith obeyed and told his father, who answered his son, that it was of God and to go and do as commanded by the messenger. Smith, who was rebuked by the preacher years earlier, had to choose to accept that first vision, yet years later, we see upon another series of visions, Smith had his father to reinforce those visions as valid. For years after this experience, the Smith family would stand behind Joseph in supporting his visions. Again, the one angle that we should consider in these early visionary experiences is that Smith learned that visions gave answers. Smith could not find answers to critical questions from clergy or his own study. They came through visions. Hence, visions became an important part of his personal religious life, and ultimately this belief gave him the desire to help others achieve the same experiences and a fullness of glory. The first distinct indication in Joseph's life in which we see his desire to encourage others to experience the gifts and visions that he experienced is when Oliver Cowdery joined with him as scribe in the translation process of the Book of Mormon. It was not long after Oliver Cowdery started to scribe for Smith that he became increasingly interested in trying to translate as well. Upon Cowdery's request, Smith and Cowdery received a revelation that granted Oliver the ability to participate in translating. This revelation was clear in indicating that Cowdery had two gifts. The first of those gifts was the spirit of revelation, and the second gift mentioned in the revelation was declared as the gift of working with the rod. This reference to the rod is probably indication of Cowdery's past use of a divining rod. These rods were often used within the culture as a form of magic that may have been used in treasure seeking. There is not any reason to believe that Oliver's family from Vermont, like several others at the time, were opposed to mixing magic and Christianity. This practice was common and is important to the understanding of Smith allowing Oliver to experience this translating process. The concept of the rod, which was used to discover hidden things, and the seer stone that Smith was using to translate the Book of Mormon, both had their background in the magic culture of the day. When Oliver was acting as scribe, Joseph placed his seer stone in his hat and then placed his head into the hat, using the seer stone to translate the plates as they laid covered on the table. Since, as the revelation indicated, Oliver had past experience with this rod, that it could be assumed that Cowdery would feel comfortable working with the seer stone in the translating process. After all, he was familiar with this culture. When looking at Joseph Smith as a spiritual egalitarian who pushed for others to experience the same spiritual manifestations that he did, the translation process with the seer stone is just one of many spiritual events that Smith did experience in his life, and obviously would want others, such in this case Cowdery, to experience. Smith's willingness to allow Cowdery the ability to translate is a very act of encouraging Cowdery to experience the spiritual manifestations of this process. Smith wanted Cowdery to experience and share in the same events that he was engaged in. The translating experience did not go well for Oliver, for when he tried to translate, he just could not do it. A subsequent revelation provided the reason for his lack of success. He had simply believed that God would tell him what to say without any effort on his part. Cowdery was addressed, "You have not understood. You have supposed that I would give it unto you when you took no thought, save it was but to ask me. But behold, I say unto you that you must study it out in your mind. Then you must ask me if it be right. And if it is right, I will cause that your bosom shall burn within you. Therefore you shall feel that it is right." Scholarly debate could fill volumes as to what is required in order to translate. The revelation here alludes to the fact that it is more than a mere mental process than just looking into a stone and receiving the answers. However, from how Joseph went about the translation process, it is evident that Oliver believed the process to be easier than it actually was. Oliver Cowdery might not have been able to translate the Book of Mormon when given this opportunity, but this doesn't take away from the fact that Joseph Smith wanted him to experience the translation process for himself. Oliver Cowdery would have other opportunities with Joseph Smith in experiencing visionary experiences. On May 15, 1829, when Cowdery and Smith went into the woods to pray regarding baptism, they both shared in the experience of John the Baptist appearing to them and restoring the Aaronic priesthood. Several years later, on April 3, 1836, in the Kirtland Temple, Cowdery would also share the visionary experience of seeing Moses, Elias, and Elijah restore other priesthood keys. Yet Cowdery was not the only one to share visions with Smith in important Mormon events. Sidney Rigdon had the privilege of seeing in unison with Joseph on February 16, 1832, a vision of God the Father, Jesus Christ, and the three degrees of glory that would play an important role in Mormon doctrine. Now, moving back in time, the revelations regarding Oliver Cowdery and his desire to translate are important to us in another regard. These revelations either alluded to the fact or at least opened up the idea that others such as Cowdery could experience revelation just as Joseph Smith did. In the early history of the Mormon Church, there is an event that caused some clarification regarding these notions of the spirit of revelation. The event itself helped to establish Joseph Smith as the main leader of the church and must be mentioned because it appears, only at first glance, to be a possible halt to Joseph Smith's desires that others experience the same things as he did. After the publication of the Book of Mormon in March of 1830 and the subsequent formal organization of the Mormon Church that April, people in the church started to receive revelations that were correcting Joseph Smith and proclaiming things pertaining to the church as a whole. The first of these conflicts came in the summer of 1830 involving Oliver Cowdery, who by this time had been called to be the second elder of the church behind Joseph Smith. This conflict also involved the Whitmer family. Both Cowdery and the Whitmer family started to correct some of the revelations that Smith had obtained. Joseph was adamant about putting a stop to what was going on and was forceful in his efforts. Joseph wrote to Cowdery asking, quote, "by what authority he took upon him to command me to alter or erase, to add or diminish from a revelation or commandment from Almighty God." Smith did not take the matter as a simple trivial issue. This idea of authority issues becomes even more worrisome to Smith a short time later, when Hiram Page, another member of the church, said he was receiving revelations through a seer stone for the body of the church. Hiram Page was gaining momentum and popularity with these revelations, and many people, including Oliver Cowdery, were starting to follow his revelations. Smith, upon learning about this, decided to take the matter up and discuss it in a September conference of the church. It was in this conference that Smith tried to settle the matter by giving out a new revelation for the church. The revelation declared, "No one shall be appointed to receive commandments and revelations in this church, excepting my servant Joseph Smith Jr., for he receiveth them, even as Moses." In one single sentence of this new revelation, Smith placed himself as the head of the church and formally gave himself the role of prophet, exactly as Moses was a prophet. The revelation further stated that Cowdery, the second elder of the church, was to be like Aaron, to faithfully declare the commandments and revelations with power and authority unto the church. Cowdery was also instructed to take Hiram Page one-on-one and explain to him the order of the church, and that what Page received through his seerstone was only Satan trying to deceive him. This event is important for discussion because it can appear from this moment on that Smith, when it came to revelation and manifestations, was opposed to others experiencing what he did. This is far from the truth. It would be easy to see the reason why Smith felt that he had to give this new revelation. With several people in the church declaring that they were receiving revelation for the whole, it would not be long until either anarchy or splinter groups would start to form. This revelation allowed Smith to bring some order to the structure of the church, but did not destroy his inclinations to help others see visions and manifestations as he did. The revelation, although stating that only Smith was to receive revelation for the church, still gave Cowdery the opportunity to have the Comforter or the Holy Ghost. When Cowdery first desired to translate, he was given the previous revelation, stating that one of his gifts was the Spirit of Revelation. The Spirit of Revelation was made in reference to this Comforter or Holy Ghost. In this light, it can be seen that in the revelation of September 1830, the conference there in that day, that Smith declared the ability for others to receive revelation for themselves for the sole purpose to preach the gospel. However, when it came to revelations and commandments for the whole church, only Smith could have those. The question is still left, however, does this not end Joseph Smith's spiritual egalitarianism? If we continue through some events in Mormon history, there is evidence to suggest that Smith's inclinations continue well after this period. Perhaps no other doctrinal revelation that Smith received indicates this trend as much as a revelation given in September of 1832. In discussing the issues of Zion and the building of a temple lot, this revelation became a discourse on the nature and the structure of the church's priesthood. In this revelation, the lineage of priesthood from Adam down to the present day is given in heavy detail. Smith stated in reference to the higher Melchizedek priesthood that without this, no man can see the face of the Father and live. The revelation then stressed that Moses tried to teach the Israelites this principle while they were in the wilderness, that through sanctification they would be able to literally see the face of God. A verse in this revelation indicates a doctrine corresponding to Smith's inclinations of what he wanted his followers to receive. In reference to the Israelites, it stated, "They hardened their hearts and could not endure his presence. Therefore the Lord in his wrath, for his anger was kindled against them, swore that they should not enter into his rest while in the wilderness, which rest is the fullness of his glory." The Israelites, although Moses tried to help them, could not endure the presence of the Lord. In result, the people of Moses had the higher priesthood taken away from them. In the teachings of Smith, that priesthood had been reestablished again on the earth in the latter days, and the Latter-day Saints at the time had possession of it. The saints were not able to be like the Israel, or the saints were not to be like the Israelites. Smith wanted the saints to see God and receive of his fullness. As much as he tried to get the priesthood holders to comply with this doctrine, Smith, like Moses, could not always get his people to comply. In Kirtland, at the beginning of 1836, prior to the dedication of the Kirtland Temple, Joseph started to introduce the principle of the temple washings and anointing. On February 6, 1836, Smith organized the various priesthood quorums that had been anointed together in the various rooms of the temple to seal them unto all of their blessings. His own journal indicated the intensity he put into this meeting. And I quote from that, "I labored with each of these quorums for some time to bring them to the order which God had shown to me, which is as follows. First part, to be spent in solemn prayer before God, without any talking or confusion. and the conclusion with a sealing prayer by President Sidney Rigdon, when all the quorums are to shout with one accord a solemn Hosanna to God and the Lamb with an Amen, Amen, and Amen. And then all take seats and lift up their hearts in silent prayer to God. And if anybody, and if anyone, or if any obtain prophecy or vision, to rise and speak, that all may be edified and rejoice together. The above statement from Smith's journal makes it obvious as what he was trying to get these men to do, which was to get them ready to receive visionary experiences. The record then relates that Smith had trouble getting the elders to follow his instructions. The various offices of the priesthood were divided into different rooms in the temple, depending on if they were high priests, members of the 12, the 70, etc. Smith, although in a different room than the elders, felt that something was going wrong with the elders' quorum. He sent Oliver Cowdery and his brother Hiram to go fix the problem. Smith continues in his journal, "The quorum of elders had not observed the order which I had given them, and were reminded of it by President Carlos Smith, and mildly requested to observe order and to continue in prayer as requested. Some of them replied that they had had a teacher of their own and did not wish to be troubled by others. This caused the Spirit of the Lord to withdraw. This interrupted the meeting, and the quorum lost their blessing in a great measure." This journal entry indicates the struggle that Smith had and the frustration that occurred when his instructions were being ignored. Smith was endeavoring to teach these men the doctrine of the church and trying to sanctify them in order to obtain visions together. The men of the elders' quorum, in Smith's perspective, lost their blessings. Smith's inclinations remained strong here in 1836, just as it was with Oliver Cowdery in 1829. He wanted those around him to experience what he did. Perhaps the ultimate concluding example in the life of Joseph Smith that shows his inclination for members of the church, and for the world in that matter, to have spiritual manifestations and visions the way he did, is found in his King Follett discourse. In this sermon, Smith declares that he is going to lay out the very character of God and what it is to obtain eternal life or exaltation. Before he starts a discussion on God, Joseph declares, "I'm going to inquire after God, for I want you all to know him and to be familiar with him." Here is the first indication in the sermon that Smith is reaching out to teach the saints to know God as he did. When Smith started his discussion on God, he declared that God himself once went through all of what mankind is currently going through, that God himself was at one time as any human being is presently, but that he is now an exalted man. Smith holds nothing back in teaching this doctrine and indicates the idea of revelation and knowing the character of God as being an important part of the gospel. Smith commented, "It is the first principle of the gospel to know for a certainty the character of God, and to know that we may converse with him as one man converses with another, and that he was once a man like us. The only way, as Smith taught, that members of the church were to understand the true character of God was through revelation." This relates to the very story of Smith being rebuked in his youth by the preacher. The preacher told him that there was no such things as visions or revelations in these days, that all such things had ceased with the apostles, and that there would never be any more of them. Smith, as mentioned earlier, had to determine in his childhood whether he would believe in these revelations or whether he would not. Part of his acceptance of these revelations meant that Smith had to accept the revelations that could come to him could also come to others. Revelation and understanding the character of God go together, according to the King Follett discourse. You can't have one without the other. Smith's principle of wanting others to experience visions goes along with this concept of revelation. If revelation only allows one to understand the character of God, then this is but the first step. The second step in this process, Smith stated, was when we understand the character of God and know how to come to him, he begins to unfold the heavens to us and to tell us about it. In this one line of the King Follett discourse, Smith indicates the importance of heavenly manifestations or visions in the pursuit of one's exaltation or eternal life. And understanding Smith's teachings of eternal life in this discourse helps one understand his inclinations for others to receive visions. He states, "Here then is eternal life, to know the only wise and true God, and you have got to learn how to become God yourselves and to be kings and priests to God, the same as all gods have done before you, namely by going from one small degree to another, and from a small capacity to a great one, from grace to grace, from exaltation to exaltation, until you attain the resurrection of the dead and are able to sit in glory and do as do those who sit enthroned in everlasting power. The information of the King Follett discourse given just a few months before his murder is the capstone of the doctrines that indicate why he was inclined to have others see visions and experience things as he did. According to the doctrinal thoughts of Smith, all must be able throughout their lives to grow from one capacity to the next, from grace to grace, with the ultimate goal of being enthroned in the heavens. The King Follett discourse is really the accumulation of all the events that have been discussed. Smith learned to accept visionary experiences while he was growing up. Due to his belief in visionary experiences, it did not seem out of place for Smith to allow Oliver to try in the translating process. In the very doctrine that Smith taught, the Israelites refused to sanctify themselves to see God, and therefore lost the ability to enter into God's rest, which was the fullness of God's glory. Smith himself became frustrated when he taught the very same doctrine that Moses was trying to teach, and the elders would not comply. All of these examples give a summary of the visionary element of Joseph Smith's spiritual egalitarianism. Now the second element, the organizational element. Although for this presentation I will spend less time on this element, there is indication in Smith's organizational structure that he was a spiritual egalitarian. I specifically bring this organizational element out to bring the issues of race and gender into the conversation. To do so, I will first discuss Smith's views on blacks in the priesthood. Following this, I will discuss Smith's views on women in the church organization, the Relief Society, and specifically the issues regarding the temple ordinances, as discussed in the Anointed Quorum. Now we must ask how this organizational element applied to race issues. Did Smith spread his egalitarian principles to black members of the church? The answer is yes, Smith did. There might not be any direct statements by Smith discussing the issue of blacks in the priesthood, but there is enough evidence to state in the time of Joseph Smith there was no black priesthood denial. In the records of the church, we know that there was a black man named Elijah Abel, who was among those holding the priesthood in Kirtland, Ohio. Abel was baptized in 1832, and by December of 1836, he had not only received the Melchizedek priesthood, but was ordained to the office of a 70. Not only do the records of the entire church, the records of the church indicate that he was a holder of the priesthood, but a patriarchal blessing given by Joseph Smith Sr., the prophet's father, further proves this. Within the blessing, Father Smith declared that Abel was ordained an elder and anointed to secure thee against the power of the destroyer. It is clear from this indication that Abel, and even those around him, knew that he was a priesthood holder regardless of his race. Elijah Abel was not the only black man to receive the priesthood either. There was also a black man in Lowell, Massachusetts, named Walker Lewis, who was ordained an elder by William Smith, the younger brother of the prophet. Placing these two priesthood holders together, we get a strong argument that Smith would have been accepting of blacks having the priesthood in the church organization. After all, Smith's father mentioned the matter in a patriarchal blessing, and his younger brother even ordained Walker Lewis to the priesthood. Smith would have easily known and approved of what was going on, since the people doing these things were Smith's own family. Therefore, side evidence gives us a strong case. If the family connection was not enough, there is also some evidence that Smith himself was familiar with Elijah Abel. We know that when Abel moved to Nauvoo, he was intimately acquainted with the prophet and lived in his home. This is the most striking evidence that we have in which Smith would have known and acknowledged Abel as among the body of priesthood, especially since Abel was listed as a priesthood holder in the records of the church up until Abel's death in 1884. Perhaps the most unique insight we get of Smith regarding race is the conversation he had with Elder Hyde in January of 1843. Before I mention the following quote, it should be noted that Elijah Abel remained active but moved to a branch of the church in Cincinnati in 1842. Upon the race issue, Smith declared, "Go into Cincinnati, or any city, and find an educated Negro who rides in his carriage, and you will see a man who has risen by the powers of his own mind to his exalted state of respectability." This quote is intriguing because only months previous, Abel, who shared Smith's home, moved to Cincinnati. Smith very well thought of Abel when he said this statement. Granted, it might not be in reference to the priesthood, but it shows the prophet's thoughts on equality of the races. Finally, what about women in the organization of the church? If we consider women and Smith's teachings to them regarding the temple, we understand how the prophet brought women organizationally to experience spirituality, as did others. On April 28, 1842, Smith taught the Relief Society in Nauvoo regarding the priesthood and stated that the sisters, quote, would come in possession of its privileges, blessings, and gifts. With the coming instruction of the temple endowment, sisters were going to experience this promise. Prior temple ordinances were early in development in Kirtland and basically were in preparation for the men to serve missions. In Nauvoo, women were to experience blessings at the temple as well. Smith had something in mind. Smith was going to give women authority in the church. In March 1842, he taught the sisters that he was going to make of this society a kingdom of priests, as in Enoch's day, as in Paul's day. On May 4th, 1842, we know that Smith started an organization in his red brick store called the Anointed Quorum. Here he taught several men the temple endowment while the temple was still in construction. By 1843, women were being invited into this quorum and being instructed on receiving their endowments and how to perform them for others. What is abundantly clear from this history is that women were being ordained to perform salvation essential temple ordinances. Emma Smith, the first to receive the temple ordinances, along with presiding over the Relief Society, also presided over the women ordained and given authority to perform temple ordinances. Although subtle as this might sound, this was huge. Women were being ordained to perform ordinances. Women were soon being declared as priestesses as they stepped up to the temple work that was asked of them. Although Smith was killed before the temple was complete, this development continued. Between December 1845 and February 1846, 36 women, many original members of the Anointed Quorum, officiated as priestesses in the temple, helping the men perform in total 5,000 endowments and nearly 3,000 sealings. Even up to this day, women help perform these sacred initiatory rites in the temple. In 1839, Joseph Smith declared, "If there is no change of ordinances, there is no change of priesthood. Wherever the ordinances of the gospel are administered, there is the priesthood." Although how much authority Smith placed on the sisters is often debated in academic circles today, we must definitely acknowledge the elements of the Anointed Quorum, and specifically women and the temple, as a sign of spiritual egalitarianism in Smith. The women were grateful for this great inclusion. Eliza R. Snow declared, "Thanks be to God for the holy ordinances of his house, and how cheerfully grateful we ought to be that we are happy participants of these great blessings." Throughout his life, Smith gave evidence through his actions and doctrines the inclination he had to have others experience visions and manifestations as he did. Smith came to terms with his spirituality by experimentation and accepting the experiences and visions he had as true. Those experiences were what brought him to God. There is little to doubt that Smith also wanted those to follow him to come to God in the exact same ways. After all, that is what a successful leader of any organization does. A leader leads the people to the exact goal of the organization in the best way he or she knows possible. We see that Smith performed the spiritual egalitarianism by both visionary elements and organizational elements. And returning to the King Follett Discourse, perhaps that sermon was one of the last great requests the Mormon prophet made to his followers before he died. He urged them to understand God the same way that he did, step by step, following his lead, until they slowly converse with God as one man converses with another. After all, Smith believed he did this throughout his own life. The little irony that Smith left at the end of his King Follett Discourse was this comment: "I don't blame anyone for not believing my history. If I had not experienced what I have, I would not have believed it myself." Perhaps, although he did not say it, this is why Smith tried so hard to be a spiritual egalitarian, so that everybody would be able to experience what he had experienced and then believe. Thank you.
We want to thank Brian and Christopher for these excellent papers. very interesting material. Are there any questions now? Yes.
When you first stumbled across the information on the visits by these various Indian groups?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it was while reading the history of the church that there was just there's a couple of the delegations that are in the history of the church.
And the others are mentioned where?
Journals, letters. And some of them are more extensive in the manuscript histories than in the published history of the church. So, just a lot of primary source documents.
A lot of time in the church library.
A lot of, like, I found a lot of stuff on the DVD collection put out by the BYU, and there was one that was in Vogel's early Mormon documents. So I haven't actually scoured the archives yet, and so there's probably still more stuff in there on these delegations. And really, I think the reason that they've been neglected so much is that the sources are so fragmentary and so obscure in some cases that you really only start to see the whole picture when you put it all together. And it was only sort of that systematic going through and trying to find all these sources and piece them together that brought the picture, flushed it out. Yes?
Just following on that, did you consult any secondary sources on this, particularly work by Ron Walker?
Yes, Ron Walker's work was excellent, and also Lawrence Coates has commented, but each of them only dealt with small pieces of this, and neither of them, I think, really put the Indian side of the story into the political context, you know, the British bands and the factionalism that was happening. So.
Yes.
A question for Brian. If I understood you correctly, in thinking of the Oliver Cowdery translation of the Book of Mormon effort, the impetus for that experiment came from Oliver, but that you portrayed Joseph as being enthusiastic about this, as wanting to share this gift with him. Whenever I've read this, I imagine Joseph sort of having to go along, being reluctant, but he claims a gift and here's this wonderful guy who's helping him and he's basically got to accommodate him. Mm. And as soon as it doesn't work out, he says, it's not profitable or whatever the word is for you to continue with this at this time or something like that. Do you have any evidence that, I buy all the stuff later about Joseph, wanting other people to share in revelatory experiences, many years later after the Hiram Page thing is sort of settled, who's really in charge. Do you have evidence that Joseph was enthusiastic about this at that time, or is that just speculation?
That's a very good question. I think that I probably, for the time being, as far as evidence-wise, would probably have to say that that was more so my own feeling, that because of some other events in his life about people experiencing things, these spiritual things the way he did, that it sort of fit in line with the Oliver Cowdery story. Interestingly enough, it was in concept of Oliver Cowdery in the translating process that I sort of was starting to formulate this idea of a spiritual egalitarian, or defining Smith as a spiritual egalitarian to sort of describe and define those inclinations of Smith, because in Rough Stone Rolling by Richard Bushman, when he's talking about Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery and the experience, he does a little, it's almost in just one sentence, he mentions that many people have noticed that there are times where Smith gets others involved in the work that they were doing. So it just was sort of a little side comment. Now, actually a statement where Smith declares, like, oh, I was so happy that, Oliver, Cowdery could try to do that. I wanted him to do that. I don't really have any information on that. I mean, we do know that Oliver asked to, but I think that Smith was definitely willing. I think a big part in my mind, too, that I took out of this paper that was interesting is Smith was willing to hear him out because he had just been through a whole lot of painful experiences in his life with the lost 116 pages. There was so much time lost in the translation of the Book of Mormon. And to sit here and then say, okay, Oliver, I'll give you a chance to try it, to me, I would just be, if I was in a hurry or upset about a loss of time because of my own fault, I'd feel like, oh, gee, I, you know, no time. Let's just keep going through it. Just let me do it. And so, again, I guess those are initial, you know, suppositions on my part based on the history.
That sort of cuts both ways. I mean, he definitely didn't want to lose Oliver at that point. This was the one sort of remaining scribe who was still with him, and he would have lost a lot of time if he'd had to if he lost him too. I mean, I'm just working off my intuition too. I have no idea.
Oh, definitely, yeah, and that's sort of what I did with that. I will admit that.
Liz?
Okay, just like in your opinion, from your study and from your things, like, do you think, you know, this experience that Joseph had, this egalitarianism point of view that he shared, do you think that it came from like just a deep humility that he had? Like, well, you know, I'm having these experiences, so like everybody else should too. Like, I'm not elevating myself. Or do you think it came from a need? Because I would imagine somebody in Joseph's position would feel very isolated from his community and from his family, even, that he's just been separated, and that's a bit of a scary situation. And so if somebody else was also having these powerful experiences, that he would be in good company, you know, that there would be, you know, some kind of camaraderie. Or do you think he was just that generous, that he just, like, wanted people to share in the same kind of benefits that those experiences provided?
All right, is it an acceptable answer to give both? And I'll explain why. Okay. I think the both would be because I do think that Smith did sort of have a generosity in his life and a humility. But I think to the isolation part, I think that might also be a big important principle to want people to... I mean, if people thought you were crazy, there's no way you could have experienced those things. It would be really isolating. I think a big part of that, maybe in the history of Smith's life, where we can see that joy of not being isolated, is when he spent all this time being the only one to see the plates. And then we know from, of course, it's in a later on account by his mother years later of Joseph Smith's life, that when he just walked into the house, and I'm paraphrasing, but he was so happy that a burden had been lifted off his shoulders, that other people had seen the plates. And could visually see what he had been talking about this whole time. I think very much the isolation aspect probably would have fit in to this picture as well.
And I have another question.
Go ahead.
Regarding like the similarities between, because like Moses kind of did the same thing, you know, he tried to set up all of these situations for the children of Israel so that they could have the same kind of communions with God that he had. And both Moses and Joseph were dispensation heads. So do you think that like that would have anything to do with that, you know, that kind of vigor to, I mean, because like you're trying to kickstart a whole new, you know, headspace essentially when you're a dispensation head. So, I mean, how would you correlate those two? What's your opinion on that?
You know, I probably would have to think more on that. I never really thought about the dispensation head mentality. I mean, some of what I also, just for time, cut out of this paper, but thought maybe I was fudging the argument a little too much, is I also would compare Smith to Enoch. Although the only difference that I thought was where the fudge was, that I realized, was here is Enoch, where people are going to go experience of seeing God by being risen up to God, when here's Moses that's trying to get people to see God while on the earth. And I thought it was a bit of a stretch, but the reason I bring that up is it could be a potential question to ask, because Enoch could also be considered one of those heads.
Well, and just doctrinally speaking, the reason why the city of Enoch was taken up was because they had attained a celestial level of existence on earth that they would be, they would have had in the presence of God, that implying that they might have already seen God, you know, because they had just gotten
it. True. Sanctification process would get thrown in there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, hand back there.
Yeah, a couple things. I think that part about Enoch, I mean, I'd like to read it at some point and see if I think it's fudge, but I think there's a clear comparison there. That's also important to note, Enoch bringing his people into a Zionist thing to see God. I wanted to address this question a little bit, if that's okay, about whether or not Joseph wanted Oliver Cowdery, you know, whether that was his desire. It seems consistent with Smith as initially not understanding his role maybe as a leader and growing into that, that he looked to people who were more educated, like Sidney Rigdon and others, to really take the lead in many cases, and Oliver Cowdery was much more educated than Joseph Smith. And it also seems consistent with Joseph Smith during the process of bringing out the Book of Commandments and the Doctrine and Covenants, he would actually have Sidney Rigdon and others actually go through, and they would do some of the editing even without him present. So it seems consistent that Joseph Smith would be fine having that help there. I also wanted to mention to Brian a source you might want to take a look at that I think would really help here contribute to your argument is the School of the Prophets, especially the account by Philo Dibble, where they essentially build a miniature Zion and have a visionary experience that you're discussing, and at the end, Joseph Smith essentially does the same thing as he did with witnesses, saying, you know, I'm so happy that this happened to you, now I'm not the only one.
Thank you.
One?
Both from what you say and from my own reading of this early period, I get the impression that much of the appeal in the Prophet Joseph's teaching and much of what he tried to actually convey was a sense that he was not so much the sole mouthpiece of God, but was first among equals, that his initial associates were all people who buy into his program, as it were, because of their firm belief that they had as much access as he had. And he encouraged that. And I think he really believed in it. But from my own kind of sociological bent here, I recognize that with growth in organizations, the certain inevitability sets in that makes increasing oligarchy and centralization of authority absolutely essential. So a lot of, I think, what we need to understand that Joseph faced was not just that he had to somehow deal with, in a personal way, with threats to his personal authority, but that you couldn't get an organization to last very long and grow if you had more than one central mouthpiece for God. We need to remember that when Joseph moved, by the time Joseph moved to Kirtland, the church had already doubled from what it was in Palmyra, or more than double. And then by the middle of the 1830s, it was probably a couple thousand members. So, you know, you've got to have central control. So I think all I'm doing is suggesting that you keep in mind these inevitable sociological factors, and not just the personal proclivities and struggles of the individuals involved.
Thank you.
Another question?
Yeah, for Chris. One of the foundational arguments you use is this concept of Joseph Smith believing that the United States would be destroyed, bringing that from the Book of Mormon. Is that an interpretation that you use, or who else kind of goes with that interpretation from the Book of Mormon, and where in the Book of Mormon are you referring to?
Okay. There are passages where it talks about basically the Lamanites will be like a roaring lion who will go through and destroy and all this. Parley P. Pratt in the 1850s or 60s, I think, said that if this didn't happen, if the United States wasn't destroyed by the Native Americans, that it would prove the Book of Mormon false. Marvin Hill has promoted this interpretation. There are a few others, but I can't put my finger on it right now.
I think it's pretty well known that Brigham Young believed it. He taught that Lamanites would help the Mormons defeat the United States, basically. I think he fully expected the North to lose the Civil War. and that he would wind up in charge of the United States, and then he and his associates would wind up running the world as the world governments fell apart.
Well, and Joseph Smith on multiple occasions in Nauvoo prophesied the complete overthrow of the U.S. government within a few years. So once before Congress, he said this, once in the Council of 50, and then once at dinner with Stephen Douglas.
There's one passage in the Doctrine of Covenants that can be read that way too, and I want to say 115, but there's this phrase that there will be a full end to all nations, full end of all nations. And I think it's 115, but it's in line with this basic thing.
The Civil War prophecy in the Doctrine of Covenants has it in there too, that at the same time as the Civil War is going on, the remnant of Israel and the Lamanites are going to be ravaging things.
Well, then why the involvement in the Mormon Battalion and in the Rumsfeld presidency if the United States was to be lost? Do you think this is a one-time, maybe an earlier interpretation that it kind of evolves differently, or do you think he held this as a solid belief?
You know, it's funny because Joseph Smith is making those prophecies about the overthrow of the United States at exactly the same time that he's running for president and, you know, addressing Congress for redress. And I think part of it is he's framing these prophecies conditionally. He's saying, if the United States does not repent, does not redress our grievances, does not elect me president, etc., then they're going to be overthrown in just a few years. And so, I mean, Joseph Smith has kind of this paradoxical attitude to the United States. If he thinks that he can turn it to his own ends, then he's going to do that, and he's going to sort of ally himself with it. He talks in the Doctrine of Covenants, he says, make friends with mammon. So he's very willing to sort of appropriate the government for his own ends. But at the same time, it's clear throughout his ministry, he has sort of this polemical attitude toward it, that it's really wicked and sinful. And it's only good to the extent that it sort of serves Mormon purposes.
Well, the Mormon Battalion was not a reflection of any patriotism on Brigham Young's part.
It was, yeah, they needed money to be able to get to Utah, because they were, you know, stranded.
They were still cussing the United States out all the way across the plains and all during the Utah period, as far as I can tell. Mm-hmm.
Okay, any final questions? Yes.
I had a couple thoughts on the spiritual egalitarianism and the particularly the question of translation. Someone had mentioned in the School of the Prophets, like Philo Dibble, talking about visions that Joseph Smith had been preparing them for. There's something very detailed and very similar from Zebedee Coltrane that I don't know if you're familiar with. They're actually visions of deity. They're promoted by Joseph. On the translation issue, in D&C 6, that's the first revelation to hint at Oliver maybe being able to translate. And it actually says that the keys of translation are given to Joseph and Oliver. We're used to thinking of keys being like priesthood keys. Mm-hmm. But at that time, like Lucy Smith used the term key to refer to the seeing instruments. So I think it's probably actually talking about the seer stones. And after Joseph completes the Book of Mormon translation with his brown seer stone, he gives it to Oliver Cowdery, which is actually how Brigham Young ends up with it from Oliver. So that would tend to suggest that he did, he was willing to share this gift.
Definitely, thank you for that. I had not looked into D&C 6 in that light. That definitely sheds more light and strength on that.
All the female members of the Quorum of the Anointed were brought in as wives of males, right?
Correct, yeah. Because what would happen is they would receive their endowment, their initiatories and their endowments, and then following, and sometimes a week or two later, they'd then be sealed together.
But there were no single women in them.
From the names I'm rattling off, just the few that I can think at the top of my head, I don't remember reading any single women that were brought into
there. There probably weren't any single men in them either.
Probably not. One of the reasons that there might not have been any single women that were getting brought into the Quorum anyway is because part of the anointed Quorum was also the initiatory teaching of polygamy into Nauvoo. And so I'm willing to assume if single women got brought into it, they probably would be brought into polygamy. Mm-hmm.
Okay, any more? It's time to adjourn. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for very fascinating papers.
Thank you.